Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Joe Blowers. Joe, I am so happy to have you with me.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
I was thinking before we got started that, I mean, I've known you for a pretty long time, but I'm not sure that I know the answer to this question, which is, where were you born?
I was born in Callaway, Nebraska, pretty close to the center of the state.
Was that a home area for your parents, or what's the story?
Yeah, my dad grew up not too far from Callaway. My hometown was actually Arnold, where I went to high school, but they're both tiny little towns of 600 or 800, and Callaway just happened to have a hospital, a rural hospital.
How many siblings do you have, and where do you fit in the family?
I'm the oldest, and I have a brother who's 2.5 years younger, and then two sisters that came quite a bit later, so much later that I actually remember telling them bedtime stories and tucking them in bed, and kind of functioned as a de facto father when my dad was so busy.
So in some ways, you almost had two families.
It felt a little bit like that. Yeah. My first sister was 6 years younger than me, but my second sister is, I'm trying to remember now. She was born more than 10 years. It's like 12 years younger than me. So yeah, she was definitely a surprise to my parents.
We used to call those little tag-alongs.
Yeah. So it felt a little bit like that. Definitely they experienced a different growing up than I did, even though we kind of overlapped a bit, like I said.
So did you live out in the country or in town, or what's that story?
My dad was a dairy farmer. My grandfather was also a farmer, but he did a lot of ranching. He literally had thousands of acres of ranch land. And so I feel like a lot of my upbringing wasn't just farming, it was ranching, you know, riding and roping and branding and castrating and all that. You know, that kind of stereotype about the Western cowboy. I did a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I think of ranching, I think of animals, and it sounds like that was indeed the case with your grandfather.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, some of my favorite experiences are things like, you know, riding my horse for 3 or 4 hours, rounding up cattle, you know, and you wouldn't see another soul, you know, and you could just ride literally for miles. And it was just me and the sage grouses and Western meadowlarks and the cows and the prairie wind.
How old were you when you learned to ride a horse?
There's a picture of me at about 2.5 on a horse. My grandmother's holding me and my grandpa's holding the reins. So I don't think they turned me loose, but it was 2.5, I guess, is when it started.
And how old would you have been when you were kind of, quote unquote, turned loose to just go out and do what you just talked about?
Yeah, it was before I was 10. I'm not quite sure. I know, you know, we did cattle drives, literal cattle drives. I mean, and part of it was right through town. And, you know, I can remember doing it at age 8 or 9. Maybe it happened before that. I don't know. But that's my memory, is 8 or 9.
So about how many head of cattle might your grandfather have had at any given time?
Well, it was actually 3 herds. It was my grandfather's and my uncle's and my dad's. My dad's was by far the smallest. You know, my memory of it is that maybe on a cattle drive, it might be 350 cattle and then that many calves. So 700 animals. You know, at first we actually tried driving the calves with the cows, but that was pretty fatiguing for the calves. And so we ended up kind of morphing into the calves would go ahead in a truck and they'd be bawling for their mothers. And so then the cows were motivated to move, which was important, like going through town. You didn't want the cows to take any detours onto people's lawns. And I have memories of these old women standing on their lawns with brooms you know, ready to swat any cow that went onto their lawn. It was very folksy, very Americana.
Talk about the Wild West, but you're in the Midwest when this happens.
Yeah, you know, where I grew up is just east of the 100th Meridian, and there's a, Nebraska has a sign on the, I think on the 100th Meridian that says where the West begins. And so, you know, we were definitely in the West in a lot of ways.
But you said that your father's farm was it a dairy farm?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm assuming you had to help out there as well. What kinds of things were you responsible at whatever age?
Well, starting pretty early, I remember, again, being out at 7 or 8 years old. Well, I had to do everything, but the things I did when I was youngest were things like feeding calves. And I can remember getting strong pretty quickly in my childhood because we'd carry, at the time we didn't really sell milk. What we sold was cream. And so there'd be all these waste milk. And so we'd feed it to the calves in huge troughs. And I can remember carrying 2 5-gallon buckets of skim milk after we'd taken the cream off. And I know I wasn't 10 years old yet. And so you definitely get used to hard work, and it definitely built up my muscles.
So you said that your brother was, what, about 2 years younger than you?
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
What was your relationship like with him? I mean, was he right there beside you when you were doing this, or what are your personality types?
My brother and I got along pretty well. I would say it was we definitely had our competitive moments, and I was often jealous of him because he was faster than me and funnier than me and better at games than I was. So that was always irritating. But in a lot of ways, in spite of all those things, I was definitely more of a leader, I think, than he was, you know, in terms of kind of setting the tone for where we went, you know, what we did as children. We did a lot of work together and we did a lot of playing together. And then we got really mad at each other. And once my brother threw a hoe at me, which was pretty scary in hindsight, what could have happened?
Did he hit you?
No, he missed me. But another time he was swinging a branch around. He didn't intend to hit me, but it broke and the branch came flying and hit me right square in the nose and broke my nose. So I definitely got hit by him a few times.
You went to public school, I trust?
We did, but not your normal experience. Nebraska at the time had more school districts than California, and 90% of those were one-room schoolhouses. And so when I was really young, I can remember going to the school my grandmother taught at. And, you know, I wasn't even school age, but I was doing the activities with the kids at her school. But then I went to a different one-room country schoolhouse for 9 years through eighth grade. And I never had another child in my grade. My sister's grade, which was, 6 years behind me, that was a real phenomenon because I think there were 3 or 4 girls in that grade. And it was just so weird to have multiple kids in the same grade.
So it sounds like the population of the whole school would have been relatively small.
Yeah, it was. I think that the high when I was going to school was 9 kids. It peaked after I left at maybe 13 or 14, but 9, I think, was the high when I was in.
Give me a memory of going to a one-room schoolhouse that most people probably these days wouldn't even be able to relate to.
Well, the teacher's husband would come and mow the schoolyard, which was tall grass all summer, and mow the schoolyard with a sickle mower. So the grass wouldn't get chopped up. It would just fall over, you know, it was 12-inch high, 14-inch high grass, and then it would dry in the sun. So basically it was hay, and nobody would rake it up. So as kids, there was all these pieces of wood lying around. I'm not sure why, but we basically create these lean-tos against a fence, kind of like wigwams or something. And we put these poles up against the fence and then put poles across it and then pile the whole thing over with hay, and we call them forts. Not the kind of thing kids do now on playgrounds, you know. And I can remember there was this building called a coal house, and it was a coal house because It's where they, not when I was there, they didn't burn coal, but not too many years before I was in school, they burned coal. So there was still this building that we called the coal house, and we'd play different games over the coal house. You know, like, I can't quite remember the names of them, but you'd throw a ball over the roof, and if somebody caught it, then they could come around and try to catch you, that kind of thing. And so, and then the outhouses, you know, there were no bathrooms, just outhouses. And so going out when the wind chill is, you know, it's near blizzard conditions and the wind chill is 30 below, and trying to do your business in the outhouse was a remarkable experience.
And it gets cold and snowy in Nebraska.
Yeah. Yeah. The wind never stops. Or when it does, it's so remarkable that everybody talks about it.
And that coal house, the coal was what they used to keep the schoolhouse warm.
That was 10 years before I got there, because they were burning propane by the time I got there. But there were, you know, some of those coldest days where it was super windy, it never got warm enough in the schoolhouse. There was always this chill in the air when the 30-mile-an-hour wind blowing outside.
And would the windows kind of have frost on them?
Oh, yeah. They were single-pane windows. And yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
So what was church like when you were growing up?
You know, in some ways it was everything, because I didn't know the town kids. I mean, I hardly knew the town kids. I basically only knew the country kids, which was kids that went to my school, one-room country schoolhouse, or kids that went to a different one-room country schoolhouse that was 8 miles away or something like that. And those are all the kids I knew. And, you know, 80% of those kids, or 70%, went to my church. And so it was pretty insular in a lot of ways. You know, it's kind of my whole life. And, you know, I can remember going to town, like, for swimming lessons. Our town had a little tiny pool, and they offered swimming lessons. And I can remember getting made fun of by the town kids, you know, who thought we were pretty unsophisticated. And we were. We were hicks. But it didn't feel good.
What kind of a church was it? What was the name of your church?
It was called Tulane Union Church. And it was just, it was pretty right-wing fundamentalist. You know, we didn't use those words back then, but that's a label that would describe it pretty well, with some surprising Mennonite influences that I only found out about later. But, you know, I grew up as a typical right-wing fundamentalist of the 1960s, you know.
So when it was time for high school, where did you go then?
I went to Arnold High School, which our class was the biggest graduating class of 42. And I'm pretty sure there's never been a class bigger. So I think it still has the record of being the biggest class. Apparently, middle of the baby boom.
Yeah, middle of the baby boom, exactly. But that's a big change from being the only student in your grade to graduating in a class of 42. I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a shock in lots of ways. And I had to grow up pretty fast, and it was a little traumatic for a couple of years.
That was my next question. What was that transition like for you?
You know, in many ways, you know, I was a hick and I was wet behind the ears. I just was so naive in so many ways, you know, and so there was the town kids, you know, they thought they were so sophisticated. In truth, they were hicks too, but they were just a little more sophisticated, maybe, or a little more worldly than I was. It was a shock. You know, I can remember my first real encounter with blatant racism was there in high school. I knew at the time it was wrong. The blatantly racist jokes, those kind of things. And of course, you know, just all the locker room talk that went on too was a bit of a shock at first to me.
But were there actually minority students in the school?
You know, a tiny, tiny handful of Hispanic people, but it was tiny, you know, maybe 1%. That was about it. And there may have been a kid or two that had some Native American blood. I don't know for sure about that.
So given this way of growing up in this place, as you were going through high school or maybe earlier, what was your plan? What did you want to be when you grew up?
You know, I was pretty, my parents were not college graduates. I think they valued education in kind of a general sense, but they certainly didn't have an idea what it took to graduate from college. And so I graduated with zero clue of what I wanted to do. And, you know, my only real guidance was, believe it or not, from the U.S. Army. I took this test that basically told you what you were good at and what you were interested in. It was administered by the U.S. Army, and their goal, I guess, was to get people in the Army. But they basically told me, don't work with your hands, because I was apparently a klutz at putting things together. You know, they had these puzzles you were supposed to assemble really fast. And then they did an interest survey, and what I was interested in pointed me toward, they said I should either be a pastor or a forest ranger. And so I think that my life has basically been a mix of the two things, you know, being a science teacher, which is interesting because that's the only guidance I really had. That and the example of both my grandparents had gone to, it wasn't called college at the time, it was called normal school, but they'd both gone to normal school and become teachers. And my grandfather's teaching didn't last very long, but my grandmother was a lifelong teacher. And then, you know, I think their example, and then the example of my aunts who both went to college and graduated, kind of helped me see a little beyond what my parents maybe weren't prepared to steer me toward. So I did graduate. You know, my mom just wanted me to go to a Bible college where I could become grounded and find a girl to marry, that kind of thing. And I did. I graduated from Bible college. And interestingly,
did you do that right after high school?
I did. And again, it was a bit of a shock because I moved to Omaha. And Omaha, to a kid from a place where I'd grown up, was like New York. It was just shockingly urban. And that was, again, a big shock. But in a lot of ways, Bible college kind of told me what I didn't believe. I ended up coming out of Bible college a bit of a rebel with strong ideas of, well, I don't know quite how to say it. I was beginning to have clear ideas of what I didn't believe. A good example of that was ever since I was young, my grandmother would take me out bird watching and looking for different kinds of trees, all kinds of nature excursions. And I love those things. And so I went to college with just this profound love of nature. And of course, you know, all the time out on horseback in the prairie didn't hurt either. And there at that Bible college, I had this strong memory of telling someone, and maybe it was a group of someone, I don't quite remember, but I told them, I said, I really think it's important for Christians to care for creation, something like that. And their words were really, to me, they felt pandering and kind of like they patted me on the head almost and said, they basically said, yeah, it's really important to be good stewards, but what we're really on earth for is to win people for Jesus. And that did not sit well with me. And I was young and naive, and I didn't know how to respond to them. But somehow deep down, I knew that was wrong. And so when I left Bible college, even though I couldn't articulate it very well, I had a pretty good sense that it wasn't an either or proposition, that you didn't have to choose between caring for creation and discipling others for Jesus. And oddly enough, this college, which was very fundamentalist, had some Mennonite influence as well. And I ended up marrying a Mennonite woman, Levon, while I was at that college.
Did you meet there?
We did. And, you know, the joke was, it was called Grace Bible College at the time, or it turned into Grace University. But we joked it was Grace Bridal College because people went there to find a mate. And it definitely happened to us. And, you know, we've been married now for 46 years. And so it was the best thing that happened to me there.
And how long were you there?
I think I took 4.5 years, but it basically was 5 years to graduate.
So this was like an actual college. This wasn't just a couple of courses.
No, this is an accredited school, although it's, you know, I'd say some of their courses were a little bit of a joke, but they did have accreditation.
So what was the degree that you had when you left?
I had a bachelor's of Christian education.
Tell me where this science piece now comes in, since we need to move along and get you to, I mean, you became a science teacher. What's the story there?
Well, I told you about my love for nature. You know, the whole time I was going to college at that Bible college, I was constantly out in this forest preserve that was maybe 10 miles from the college campus. And I, you know, I'd hike miles on the trails and I'd meet people that were not from my background, you know, that were just out there nature watching, and got to know quite a few of them. And then I took a job at a backpacking store because a lot of the kids at this college had to work, and I did too, to pay my way. And at the backpacking store, I met this whole group of people that did not fit into my circle and was invited to a Sierra Club meeting. And so I went to my first Sierra Club meeting while I was going to this college. And it was like, it was an amazing experience. You know, this people with a very different value system and a very different way of thinking about the world. And I really admired those folks. And so I guess for me, it was kind of, you know, my life became a series of trying to figure out, okay, how does this fit with my faith? Because what the messages I was getting from the Bible college were very much that my faith doesn't fit with that kind of thing. I wouldn't say they were anti-environmentalist. They just didn't see it as an important thing. Waste of my time.
In some ways, when you found the Sierra Club group, did that sort of feel like in some ways you'd found another, quote, what we call your tribe? You discovered people who really did believe the way you did, at least in certain aspects of what you believed?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Yeah. And it was profoundly influential on my life. You know, I'd been a life member of the Sierra Club for a long time, and it started then. You know, and I'm really thankful for those folks that helped me see a bigger world than the tiny little world I was seeing from the perspective of that Bible college. Anyway, so I really began to realize I did not want to end up as a pastor, and I certainly didn't want to end up as a pastor in a church that had as narrow a view as the churches that I knew from this Bible college. And so a couple of things happened. One is I went back and got another bachelor's degree. Started out at the University of Nebraska, and then I ended up at a state college called Wayne State College in Nebraska. But it's in the Nebraska State College system, and got my science teaching degree, basically, a second bachelor's. And that was interesting because it was, again, it was very eye-opening, even more so than with the folks in the Sierra Club. But I was learning things in science classes that seemed at real odds with what I'd been taught about my faith. And I really had a crisis of faith at that point. And Levon kind of went through a crisis of faith at the same time. And I remember I'd wake up one Sunday morning and I'd say, I'm not going to church. And she'd say, oh, yes, you are. And she'd drag me to church. And the next Sunday morning, she'd wake up and she'd say, I'm not going to church. And I'd say, oh, yes, you are. You know, and I'd drag her to church. And if we'd ever woke up and both said that on the same Sunday, I'm not sure what would have happened. But we made it through that crisis of faith together.
And what kind of a church were you actually going to at that point?
You know, there weren't a lot of choices. There weren't any Mennonite churches around. We were going to an evangelical free, which was not very satisfactory, but it was better than nothing. And it wasn't until I was actually working in my student teaching toward the end of my second bachelor's degree, when I was living in Omaha, that we were able to find a Mennonite church and started going to it. Again, it was a kind of a weird Mennonite church. It was quite a bit more conservative than a lot of the ones I've seen over the years. So it wasn't a perfect fit, but it was nice to talk with folks who had at least a little bit broader idea of what it meant to follow Jesus. And that all happened basically as I was getting my teaching credential and then starting to teach. And I ended up being hired at the same school where I'd been a student teacher. So I taught there in a suburb of Omaha for a couple of years at the beginning of my career.
Well, we don't have a whole lot of time, and we know you somehow ended up in Oregon. So can you give me that story?
I knew that if I stayed very long in Nebraska, I'd get vested, you know, literally in the retirement system. And it just gets harder to move after you kind of settle in place. And we weren't very vested. We didn't own a house. I'd only been teaching for a couple of years. And so I felt like, you know, it's either now or never. And I wanted to live in a place where there was enough public land that I could go canoeing and hiking and just have a lot of choices to be outdoors. Nebraska has 2% public land, so it's not a place for a person like me in a lot of ways. And Levon was just happy to be a place where there were relatives and it was good gardening and there was a good church. So when we put all those things together, Oregon ranked pretty high because we had relatives here on both sides of our family, and it was a great place to garden and a place with tons of hiking and canoeing and nature opportunities. And so we ended up deciding to move here after teaching for 2 years and moved here in 1988.
I was trying to figure out what the draw might have been for Oregon, but you, as you say, there were some family on both sides, and so that was helpful, I assume.
Yeah, my sister had moved here with her husband, who was from here, from the Northwest, and my mom followed her, so they were both out here. Levon had an uncle and tons of cousins. She'd been out here numerous times to visit them, but lived not far from, they lived down in Dallas, Oregon.
Did you know that Portland Mennonite was here? How did you get connected in then with Portland Mennonite?
When we moved, we knew that Portland Mennonite existed. We didn't know where I was going to get a job, but I had 3 interviews. After the 3rd interview, I got a job offer at a school in West Hills of Portland, which is where I taught for the rest of my career. And so it just happened that my job ended up where Portland Mennonite was. And there was actually another Mennonite church in Portland at that time. We tried both of them and eventually ended up at Portland Mennonite. And I would have to say our small group was really important for drawing us in. For a while, we felt more connected, I think, to the small group than we did to the church. That's really changed. You know, we are super committed to the church and have been for quite a long time, but it's wonderful. We're actually still in a small group with one couple that was in that original small group. And it's kind of amazing the connection we have.
And you have been very involved at Portland Mennonite. You were part of the leadership team for some times, and I'm sure you've been on every committee there is. And
pretty close. I haven't been invited to be on the kitchen committee yet.
We'll make note of that.
Yeah, I'm not saying I want to be, but I have been on a lot of committees.
So as we're wrapping up, and this isn't a fair question, but that never stops me. Is there anything about you or something about you that you think that quite a few of us here at Portland Mennonite may not know that you could share with us?
A lot of my life has been as either an environmental advocate or an elected official. And I think a lot of Portland Mennonite folks they often didn't interact with me when I had those hats on. And so that may come as a surprise to quite a few people, you know, that side of my life. But to me, that grows directly out of my Christianity.
Tell us like one of the public roles that you've had in the community or the state.
Well, I spent a lot of time. There were basically 2 different directions that my advocacy took me. One was I spent a lot of my early years advocating for a better approach to harvesting forests. You know, at the time they were clear cutting forests in the mountains like crazy. And so I was advocating for a much more ecological approach. And then later in my life, I spent a long time as a transportation advocate, mostly about around bicycles, trying to encourage cities to put in bike lanes, bike paths, bike facilities, those kind of things. And then I ended up as an elected official for 12 years with Tualatin Hills Park and Rec District. And I feel good about those years. I feel like I accomplished a lot of good.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for taking the time to give us just this little glimpse into your amazing life. And thank you for being such an important part of our church.
It feels like a wonderful thing to be part of Portland Mennonite.
And we're so glad that you're there. And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. If something you heard raised questions or you discovered a connection, take the opportunity to reach out and continue the conversation. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.